Awesome.
Good morning, comrades. You were listening to Good Morning Comrade. You can get more information, goodmorningcomrade.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Comrade Morning. Today on the show, we have Jeff and Scott. We also have YouTuber and host of Low Society, Angie Speaks. How are you today, Angie?
Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to come talk to you guys today.
Yeah, me too. I really wanted to talk to you because I was mentioning before we got on, I had been listening to your Low Society show, and I really appreciate the kind of perspective that y'all are coming from, sort of critical of, not, you know, certainly not like opposed to it, doesn't seem, but sort of critical about some of the narratives that have been coming out of the George Floyd protests and the police reaction, specifically some of the sloganeering type things. I guess, did you want to talk about some of the things you had noticed and that you kind of pointed out with folks like Ben Burgess and Peter Coffin?
Yeah. In recent episodes, obviously, we've had to cover a lot of what's going on and sort of stay up to date with everything in order to be able to sort of comment on the situation as it unfolds. And yeah, we've definitely noticed a lot of liberal kind of obfuscation going on in these uprisings. And we've just sort of been trying to comment on different elements here and there. I mean, we've talked about the sort of the white kind of flagellation that's going on at the moment. There's recently that one of the best-selling books on the New York Times bestseller at the moment is this book called White Fragility. Mm-hmm. That's basically written by a corporate diversity trainer, and it sort of treats racism as if it's like an original sin, you know, that can only be sort of atoned for through individualistic work, you know. And you sort of see the same liberal kind of idea that, you know, these systemic issues can only be solved by your individual choices, whether it be through consuming books or, you know, doing things that are consuming things that are, you know, environmentally friendly, or, you know, it's all about individual choice and your choice as a consumer rather than your ability as a political actor. And then, of course, there's the fact that a lot of corporations and celebrities and, you know, big media names have decided to attach their brand to the Black Lives Matter sentiment at this moment where it's particularly expedient to do so. So there's like a lot of cynicism involved there as well. So much that's being done to obfuscate the material issues that face Black communities and sort of pushing things into the realm of culture war. I mean, here in the UK, the talk has been largely around statues and what statue is offensive and what statue isn't offensive. And, you know, it's sort of been dragged into this realm of culture war around meaningless symbols and iconography when it really should be about the material focus on, you know, on Black communities. I mean, more Black people have died this year of coronavirus than from police killings, and the Black community in America has been one of the hardest hit mm-hmm. by coronavirus because of lack of healthcare, lack of infrastructure. You know, there are so many different material issues that we could be focusing on, and I'd much rather see people coming together around a shared class struggle than being sort of dragged into culture war and warring over identity and all of this nonsense. So I guess that's where our critique stems from.
That's I'm glad you mentioned the book White Fragility, because that was something, like you said, it was number one on the New York Times bestseller list, and there was so much of this focus on the individual, and that goes for both like individual virtue and individual like vices and the punishments and credits that go along with it. So it wouldn't surprise people, I suppose, to follow that it follows sort of logically that the author of that book also partners with, you know, businesses and, you know, companies to provide sort of a corporate diversity training that sort of sets the table to take power away from workers, or highlight differences in workers who have sort of similar the same material needs and material would benefit from solidarity with one another against the boss, and then B, creating a whole parallel set of rules that can be punished. And to be clear, I don't want to like go around making excuses for people saying racist things at work or anything like that. Far from it. But I guess like subsuming and setting this groundwork by which these are your expectations on the job, and if you don't follow those expectations, we can fire you because of that, and sort of tightening that.
Well, that's the thing. Social justice has sort of been levied as a punitive discourse towards working class people. That's kind of what it's turned into. It's it's been recuperated, I would say, by the sort of white PMC classes as a way of punitively acting out towards the working class, and also as a justifying ideology for the suffering and the poverty of the working class. You know, this person deserves to suffer. They deserve their poverty. They deserve their lowly position because they're not woke on X issue, or they're not performing the correct pieties on X issue. And seeing social justice transform into a punitive discourse is definitely incredibly disheartening for me to witness as like a black person that's like affected by a lot of these issues. It's the worst sort of privilege masquerading itself as progress. And yeah, it's incredibly disheartening to see so much of what's been going on recently with this new sort of awakening, as I'm calling it, or this new sort of focus on racial awareness has made me feel more alienated as a black person. It sort of made me feel even more despairing about what the future holds. And, you know, yeah, these things will be used as an excuse to fire people. They'll, you know, and companies are always looking for that. When it comes to internal biases, that's one of the most deepest parts of you as a person. And I think it's incredibly inappropriate for workplaces to be trying to dig into people's psyches in that kind of way, especially because so much of what people do at work is coerced and you don't really have a choice. And this, if I was a white person working in an exploitative environment and I had to sit through days and days of diversity training, it would probably make me react badly too. It would make me, especially if the power relations were and the contradictions were sort of clearly at play in that regard. Yeah, there's so many haphazard solutions, so many sort of measures that are clearly just there to make, you know, people who don't necessarily have to deal with injustice in this sort of visceral way feel better about themselves. They're looking for solutions to the their discomfort around the issue of race.
I do find these kinds of... Oh, Scott, you want to say something?
So I think it's pretty weird with all these like kind of like new like voices like coming from like all these different angles that all these people are like, well, who do we go to for help? How about HR?
Right. HR is like, literally they are the boss, and they're the people who are there to hire and fire people and keep the boss sort of insulated from it. They're there to police workers. Like HR is not any worker's friend.
They're there to...
Sort of,
oh, sorry.
ahead,
I was just going to say that that's sort of the mode that the liberal left works in. The liberal left is large, is like their mode is managerial. So it doesn't surprise me that there's that sort of overlay there. There are a bunch of Karens, that want to call your manager. That's basically what we're seeing happening. And, you know, there are loads of writers and people who are a lot smarter than I am, people like Adolf Reed, you know, loads of different black Marxists who warned about the fact that these ideas around social justice, racial justice would eventually be weaponized and levied against the working class. And that's exactly what we're seeing happen right now. And it pushes the climate further towards reaction, in my opinion, as well. Mm-hmm. And the reaction is something that you can't even really criticize, because it's almost justified, even though it's playing itself out in ways that harm vulnerable minorities rather than like the white PMCs who are responsible for cultivating these modes. You can kind of understand the reaction and where it's coming from. Like, I want to throw up. I mean, I was sitting in on, you know, one of my flatmates. They had like a work call, a Zoom call, and it was basically like 2 hours of their boss going on about how Black Lives Matter and how the company, you know, gets, you know, supports the sentiment. And they had this diversity trainer who gave this big weepy speech, and I was like, I would scream, I would fucking scream and like want to punch someone if I had to sit through 2 hours of that shit. Sorry,
it's okay.
I shouldn't have sworn. But yeah, I would scream if I had to sit through 2 hours of that, like that kind of thing. And I know about, you know, my flatmate and their work situation and the exploitation that they suffer there, and you know, the long hours and the low pay, and to have to sit through that kind of thing is just patronizing and ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that does sound, yeah, I don't know. I know that when one of the things that happens with my job, I'm a teacher, they have these trainings and these videos and things like that. And most of the people that I know, you know, if they have to engage with them or deal with them with the boss directly, I guess that they would just have to suffer through it. But most of them, they'll like put the training on, put their computer to the side and go do something else anyway.
Yeah,
but these things
exactly.
are not important to people. It's just a lecture from the boss, and there'll be a test at the end of the week, you know?
Yeah,
exactly.
I used to work at the government, and it's always when stuff like that comes up, they're like, hey, we need to talk about diversity and stuff like that, or like SARC, which is like sexual assault and stuff, which is a big problem
military, baby.
In the government. But like whenever that come up, you'd be like, oh man, are you serious? Like, what are you, sorry, you don't want to go to work now? Like the thing you always talk about hating, like mm-hmm. now you want to go to work. Like it's just so bizarre, like how this like prism turns when like, people just don't want to be bothered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I definitely agree that this sort of thing definitely fosters more resentment. It creates more resentment. It makes people more hostile towards these ideas.
That's the objective, right? That's the objective, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think if they were trying to find a way to make people reject social progress, then they're doing an incredible job at it. I like I said, like, you know, it's only an accident of birth that I'm a black woman. I could have been born a white man. I could have been born an Asian man. I could have been born whatever. But just from a human perspective and from a human level, even I would find this kind of thing really like disheartening and patronizing. And maybe it would even push me towards having more resentment towards people of color if it wasn't for the fact that I'm more politically savvy than that, which most people aren't. Most workers are not politically savvy. They don't have time to be fucking politically savvy. They don't have time for any of that, you know?
They're too busy working.
They're tired, and they are just trying to sort of get by and feed their families.
Exactly. They're too busy working to be able to focus on I guess everybody does at the end of the day have a political analysis, but they can't, it's directed and sort of forged in purely experience. And when PMC people, which I mean, I'm probably in that class. I have a microphone and a radio show, and I have the ability to talk about that and and think about these things in my free time. I mean, there, obviously there are experiences there that inform the you know, positions that I hold. But at the same time, there's a big difference in that, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, I'm also part of the chattering classes as well. But it wasn't always that way. I did work in the corporate world for a while. And, you know, I sort of, as a Black person, experienced a lot of things that I would perceive as unsettling in those environments. But having to then see a bunch of, you know, higher ups performatively, you know, trying to sort of absolve themselves would make me feel even worse. Like, I would rather they just didn't talk about it.
Right.
I would much rather they just minded their own business, especially because there's like a clear power imbalance there. Like, I was talking to my friend the other day, who's also Black, the only Black person in her office, and they all like ambushed her and, you know, on the Zoom call, and like basically made her talk about her experiences with race. And, you know, there's a clear power imbalance there. If your boss is demanding that you talk about your experience with race, you have to humor them, because they are the one that, they're the people that pay you. Mm-hmm. And it feels dehumanizing. It's like when you're the only Black kid in class and, like, you know, they're teaching about slavery in history class, and everyone sort of turns around to look at you. It seems as if they're sort of trying to turn Black people in this very paternalistic way into permanently sort of racialized subjects. You can't be a human. The full depth and breadth of your humanity is sort of eroded when the neoliberal establishment decides to create this sort of gilded cage. Mm-hmm. Of permanent racialization. And, like, you know, it can be very materially expedient for you as a person of color, mm-hmm. if you sit in that gilded cage, but only at the expense of your soul, you know. So long as you are permanently racialized and all of your experience is filtered through that racialized lens, we will give you material comfort. You know, we will give you a modicum of respectability. And if you actively reject that, which I've done several times in my life, you're met through with a very, 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 very hostile response from these woke business people, basically, these woke kind of neoliberal actors. Mm-hmm. They very much despise it when minorities reject that gilded cage.
What kind of ways have they that manifested? And if you don't want to talk specifically about your experience, I understand. But I guess maybe, I don't know, could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, in the real workplace, when I was working, I worked as a literary agent's assistant for like many years before I became a YouTuber. And in the real workplace, whenever the sort of paternalistic dialogues around race would bubble up, and this was before the awakening. this was before the awakening, but, you know, whenever these sort of paternalistic ideals around ways to bubble up, I would always call out the hypocrisy, because that's who I am. I don't suffer mm-hmm. fools. Like, I'm very much in my Aquarius energy all of the time. So I'm never going to, like, just stand by, and it probably to the detriment of my career, but, like, you know, whatever. The world is ending. I would always call out the hypocrisy and be like, well, this is bullshit, and, you know, you're my boss, and there's not a lot I can say because you fucking pay me, and I don't really want to talk to you about this, because I wasn't buying into the idea, like, you know, this like weird corporate idea that we're all friends and we all have to sort of treat each other like friends and
or
family.
Or family, yeah.
I was like, well, you're not my friend. You're not my, and I didn't like any of the people that I worked with. I sort of humored them because I had to. And I was like, I don't really feel comfortable talking to you about this sort of thing because I don't know you. I just want to get on with my life and get on with my job and make my money and go home. I would rather you just kind of left me alone. And, you know, that was obviously met with a hostile response, mm-hmm. especially when other Black co-workers were sort of like, yes, finally I get to have the spotlight on me for this specific thing. And, you know, I get to sort of milk this in order to work my way up the corporate hierarchy. And I also got a hostile response from Black coworkers too, who were like, well, you should just play ball because this is materially expedient. So it was kind of like being caught between a rock and a hard place, like being pressured to perform and basically make myself a pet for my white superiors on one end of the spectrum. And then on the other end of the spectrum, being pressured by other Black coworkers who saw this neoliberal mode as a form of empowerment and saw me rejecting it as a threat to that empowerment that we were being offered. Right. And then obviously in the YouTube space as well, you know, a few months ago, there was this whole debacle about why BreadTube is so white.
Can you explain BreadTube really briefly?
Well, I don't consider myself to be a part of it, but BreadTube basically is a... It's like kind of liberal left YouTube, basically. People mm-hmm. who are who make videos on YouTube about, you know, anything considered left, whether that be socially or sometimes economically, but mostly socially. And, you know, there was obviously like a huge debacle about why it's so white. Mm-hmm. And I saw, you know, a lot of white creators, people who had bigger follow counts, bigger audiences, basically using me as the get out of guilt free card. People who I had never spoken to before, people who I have no kind of relationship with, decided they were going to sort of name drop me in order to deflect from, you know, accusations of privilege, which I also think are stupid as well. I think the accusations right. are just as stupid as the way that people react to them.
You don't appreciate being used as a shield either.
Yeah, it's just kind of like a baseball card. I kind of started to feel very dehumanized
right.
by the way that
plus three protection from racism accusations or something.
Yeah, yeah. Or they tried to sort of racialize me without necessarily engaging with the content I make or the work that I do. It's just like, you're a Black person. Here you go. And then also people doing charity too, which is another thing. Like, there have been quite a few big creators who have slung opportunities my way so that it could look like they were basically doing the good thing and elevating the Black woman's voice, not necessarily because they care about me or my work or they've engaged with my work. Or so again, like I said, the full depth and breadth of your humanity is sort of sacrificed mm-hmm. on the altar of becoming a permanently racialized subject, just like it. And, you know, I could play ball in that regard and get a lot of accolades for it. But I just doesn't sit well with me. I don't think I could live that way. I think it would drive me insane.
And it further reifies the sort of power dynamic, and it sort of makes permanent the sort of like supremacy of white folks by creating this sort of patronage system, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is it's a patronage system that's also used punitively as well. It's like, uh-huh. we'll support you so long as you... you know, fill the role of representation, quote unquote, neoliberal representation that we're presenting you with. If you do anything that steps out of that, like try to put forward a class-based analysis or talk about class solidarity, then we're going to punish you by taking away our patronage. Yeah, it's very pernicious. And, you know, Zizek said it, you know, that this public flagellation often conceals a secret enjoyment of privilege. Mm-hmm. And it means that they don't have to grapple with their position in the hierarchy, the material hierarchy. They don't have to grapple with their position in the material hierarchy. They can just perform. Mm-hmm. And they expect you to perform too. It's very, very pernicious. And if you talk about it, people are like, oh, well, Black folks and people of color are like, well, oh, you're taking away our only route to empowerment. Shut the fuck up, you know, mm-hmm. they're offering us freebies. And then the white people are like, shut the fuck up, you know, this is us trying to be good. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're saying that what we're doing isn't it, then there's no real way for us to show that we're good and holy and nice and care about you. And yeah, it's really weird.
Yeah,
the way you're explaining it almost sounds like how bribes work, because people think bribes are like, oh, I will offer you this thing and if I accept it, I have that thing and that's good for me. But how bribing really works is if you're in a position and someone offers you a bribe and you accept it, they're like, well, I've bribed you. And if you don't do everything I say, I will just, you know, destroy you.
It's blackmail.
Yeah. It definitely works that way. And you know, patronage networks on the left.
You can plug your Patreon later.
Wait, sorry, say that again.
I said you could plug your Patreon later.
Yeah, the patronage networks on the left definitely operate in that way for some people. Not everybody, but there is a contingency of people who they behave like racial lobbyists almost. Mm-hmm. That I've had like a few people will donate large sums on Patreon and be like, "Well, I want you to talk more about race. I don't want you to talk about this Marxism crap, or this like spirituality crap or any of that stuff. I want you to talk exclusively about race, basically." Mm-hmm. And if you do that, then there'll be more for you. And yeah, a lot of people who do exclusively focus on identity do have a more lucrative time. But if you're somebody who wants to put forth a class-based analysis, that's not necessarily as patron. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's very it's kind of like an incentive system in that regard for you to do the work of obfuscation. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, you don't have to, which is what I would say to other black creators, is that you don't have to, because even though it seems lucrative on the surface, it's a psychological prison at the end of the day. And like, it's an ontological prison too. So if you want to, you know, live in the spirit of intellectual honesty and personal freedom, I wouldn't recommend being white liberals' pet so that they can treat you like some kind of stupid cause, like save the whales or some dumb whatever. Like, no.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier Adolf Reed, and we were hoping to have him come on the show. I was emailing him the other day. But recently, I just started reading his son, Ture's book called Towards Freedom, The Case Against Class Reductionism. I'm sorry, against a case against race reductionism. I got it backwards. Adolf wrote an article called There Is No Such Thing as Class Reductionism, which I really think is interesting, because even if it's, and I think both of these guys have much more nuanced views than, because I actually listened to them, as opposed to how they're often portrayed. Recently, yes. Adolf was
deplatformed by the DSA,
and I'm a DSA member, and understanding like how this played out, because he is critical of the narratives that you and I and Scott were just talking about. He and Cedric Johnson and his son, not to say that like they are not like saying that racism or whatever doesn't exist, but the way that they sort of get their hooks in to the way society functions is through these essentially market mechanisms that either market mechanisms, specifically in the case of this White Fragility book, or sort of these direct material incentives, like that sort of, you know, patron client dynamic that we were just talking about. Check out Towards Freedom if you get the chance. The Case Against Race Reductionism. I just read.
Yeah, I've read it. I read it recently as well. And yeah, I mean, it's as if these I was incredibly disappointed to see the actions of the DSA. I thought it was one of the most cynical acts I've seen in a really long time, and I was very disgusted by it, because these are the sort of people who, you know, only black lives, you know, don't matter if they're black Marxist lives. You know, anybody who has a critique of the neoliberal mode as it operates is seen as this sort of suspicious actor that doesn't care about minorities and wants to sort of spread, the idea that identity politics is something that doesn't, I wouldn't say identity politics, but like the political concern for identity is something that's illegitimate, which isn't true. A lot of these issues that intersect with the issues that minorities have are material issues. Most of them are material issues, they're not cultural issues. So the idea that, you know, being black, you know, there just seems to be this strange anti-Marxist sentiment within a lot of these organizations, and especially Black Marxists. Black Marxists get a lot of shit from the neoliberal mode because you're rudderless if you reject the neoliberal mode, because any sort of form of racism and or obfuscation that comes your way is your fault for not adopting the neoliberal mode. That's their attitude, is, you know, well, we would protect you if only you would play ball. And because the broader left is so small, it's basically non-existent at this point. There's not a whole lot we have in terms of institutional power to push back against this sort of obfuscation. So it kind of makes you rudderless in that regard. I am incredibly disheartened by the cynical way that people engage with Adolf Reed's work and people like him, people who are critical of the neoliberal mode, people who don't, you know, people who criticize the market actions that are going on, in that are sort of masquerading themselves as social progress and social justice. You know, the way that things are set up now is that these criticisms are seen as criticisms of social justice themselves. And it's really, really, really disheartening to see, because part of the reason why social justice has been so toothless in the last, you know, 40 odd years, part of the reason why, you know, most of the left quote unquote movements have accomplished little to nothing is because of this neoliberal mode. It's the thing that's in the way, and we need to be able to critique it. But so many people, especially, they have a vested class interest in protecting it because it's what feeds them. So anybody who gets in the way of their sort of market maneuvers is seen as an enemy that needs to be destroyed immediately. There are people who have vested class interest in ensuring that this form of analysis doesn't flourish, because if it did, then they would have nothing to sort of, you know, cultivate social capital from.
Killing the goose that lays the golden egg, essentially.
Yeah, basically.
And
it just creates this sort of endless spectacle of culture war.
Right, which is not class war.
That we're
war.
Caught in. Yeah.
Which culture war is not class war. And that's not even to say that watching statues get knocked down and thrown into the river isn't cool. You know, I was at some of the statue protests that took place in New Orleans, and you know, it was interesting, but it's not the same as and I think I sent you an article. I wasn't sure if you got a chance to read it, but Adolf himself wrote how his sort of feelings on the statues coming down. He was sort of thrilled to see that they're not a part of the, the culture in New Orleans anymore. But that's not enough to, that doesn't do anything to, like, if you still don't have food to put on your table for your family, a statue coming down isn't going to change that.
Exactly. I mean, again, you know, like I said, I mean, I can also speak to here in the UK, which is where I'm from. So much of the focus right now in the conversation has been around these sort of symbolic maneuvers that are often being made by the white activist class, which is largely middle class, and also the white PMC class as well. In terms of things being removed from streaming networks, I mean, there was the huge controversy about Fawlty Towers being taken off, an episode of Fawlty Towers being taken off, things like the Mighty Boosh being removed, you know, basically British TV staples and classics. And then also the statues. And obviously these decisions are being made by panicked PMCs that don't really know how to engage with any of what's going on. So they're like, here's this gesture.
Mm-hmm.
And you have people on the liberal left who are celebrating it as if it's some kind of victory. And, at the same time in the UK, you know, our economy is dying from the COVID-19 outbreak. We have a draconian and inhumane Tory government that is sacrificing millions of lives on the altar of the quote unquote economy, an economy yeah. that's been built to serve nothing but the interests of the elite, and one that's
same here.
The one that's deeply anti-society, and deeply anti-human. You know, mm-hmm. the NHS has also suffered cuts, which has made it much more difficult for them to deal with the crisis. Austerity is worse than ever. We have, you know, poor and working class communities that are suffering. People are losing jobs. People are getting sick. People are dying. You know, Grenfell Tower happened 3 years ago. Yeah. I don't know if you heard about it in the States, but Grenfell Tower was basically a council estate that burned down because of neglect from the local constituency. Yes. You know, the inhabitants of Grenfell Tower had been complaining for decades about the lack of fire safety. And I lived in that area at the mm-hmm. time when it happened, and it was one of the most harrowing things that I've ever seen. You know, 74 people roasted to death. They died needlessly because of the neglect of the government. But the thing about the UK now is every single day a Grenfell Tower is happening due to coronavirus yeah. and the government neglect that has resulted from it. And you want to talk to me about statues mm-hmm. and you want to talk to me about faulty towers and what shows shouldn't be allowed on television, as if because I'm black, it doesn't mean I can engage with culture critically on my own without someone holding my hand. You want to talk to me about all of this meaningless culture war stuff when the majority of the people who died in the Grenfell Tower building were black, Asian, minority people. You know, the majority of people in this country who are suffering the worst through this outbreak have been black and Asian and other minority communities. I'm really not interested in the culture war and the spectacle. I really don't care. You could put a statue of Winston Churchill outside my house if you wanted to. As long as I have what I need to take care of myself and live my life to the fullest, I'm not interested in your culture war rhetoric. It really does not make a difference in my life. What makes a difference to me is my material interests. And I feel like the pushing, especially, you know, the American media, it seems as if they're sort of stoking the flames of a race war. They're pushing it into the realm of this sort of racialized culture war rhetoric in order to distract people from the shared class interests that they have. And the fact that this black struggle we're seeing occurring in the streets is a universal struggle, because black struggle represents all of the greatest and, you know, most potent, you know, inequalities. It represents the greatest and most potent you know, levels of injustice and excesses of the system of capitalism. So it's a universal struggle. It's not just about black people. It's about all of us. It's about the ways in which we are all you know, suffering under the current system. And yes, some of us suffer harder, but we're all suffering.
And I think one of the sort of thing, I don't know, I am with you on a lot of that for sure. And I definitely, like, today Uncle Ben's rice and Aunt Jemima's syrup both decided that they're going to change their logos. They both have sort of these caricatures of black people on them. And I mean, it's definitely better to get rid of those symbols of racism, I would suppose, but they're not a solution. They're not sufficient. Robert and I were talking. It is kind of funny in certain situations, though.
Yeah, I mean, there is that stuff, but there also is the fact that, like, they might steal this next election. Like,
right. Yeah, yeah.
But that's the thing is, I might just be a callous human being.
I don't think
maybe
you are.
But I just don't care. Like, uh-huh. I could care less. I've been eating Uncle Ben's rice my entire life, and it never occurred to me that
right.
that Uncle Ben was supposed to be a racial caricature. I just like the rice, and he seemed like a friendly face.
Right.
You know, Aunt Jemima's syrup or whatever, again, it never occurred to me at all that this was some kind of pernicious racial caricature. I just wanted something to put on my fucking pancakes. Like, I don't really care. I am actually like, maybe there are other people who are affected by it, and that, you know, that's valid. But I feel like there are bigger things, there are bigger fish to fry than these sort of symbolic kind of, these symbolic erasures of things that, and the thing is, the white establishment will be happy to give you as many symbolic erasures as you want, so long as you don't touch the things that actually matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like you know, people are sort of feeling triumphant. There are a lot of people who are feeling as if these are, yeah, they're feeling that these are victories that have been won. And it's like, they'll give you more of these false victories. They'll give you as many of these false victories as you want, so long as you don't actually touch the real economic contradictions. Uh-huh. So I would much rather see more energy devoted towards those economic contradictions than these symbolic ones. We've had enough symbolism. Obama was the ultimate culmination of that symbolism, and look where that led us.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to sort of leave that point. I did want to talk, Scott, did you have anything else you wanted to add on there? It sounded like you did.
No, it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I guess before we can move on, I just want to talk a little bit about some of the videos that you've put out, and some of the ones that I really appreciated. You did one recently about Alan Moore, who is a comic writer, a comic book author, and a magician, and I believe he calls himself a communist and an anarchist. Can you tell us a little bit about Alan Moore and some of the stuff that you put forward in that video? Because I found it was really interesting.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that was a bit of a YouTube magnum opus. One second, I'm just going to take a swig of water, if that's okay.
Sure, take your time.
One second.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Sorry,
it's okay.
Whenever I start talking and going off, then I get very thirsty.
That's okay.
Yes. So yeah, Alan Moore is definitely a figure that's had quite an impact on me since my kind of early teens. Yeah, like you said, the reason that I sort of got attracted to him is because not only was he incredibly literary and just an incredible talent in that regard. He also was somebody who came from the working class, which is incredibly rare in the UK to see somebody come from the working class and sort of have this sort of artistic excellence, you know, be a part of, especially within like the literary world and the world of art and things like that. You know, so many of the people who make it into that world are people who come from the middle classes and the upper classes. And, you know, Alan Moore wasn't just from the working class. He was from a very deprived part of England and grew up in an incredibly sort of deprived background. And, you know, this sort of through line of working class resistance has been kind of a theme in a lot of the work that he's produced. And he sort of went on to produce some of what I believe are the most important, you know, artistic works of the 20th and 21st century as well. I mean, his recent work, the novel, very big novel, Jerusalem, is basically this like magical realist, working class magnum opus that isn't just about class struggle and shared struggle. It's also about, you know, life, death, the afterlife. It's everything. It's like all encompassing. You know, V for Vendetta as well, that comic book had a massive impact on me growing up. You know, obviously it was sort of bastardized by Hollywood. All of the radical elements were removed from it for it to become a film, but the comic book was really about, you know, the rise of the far right in the 1980s. He sort of set it in a near future, which is, he's kind of created a dystopian future in order to sort of have space to work out some of the concepts that he was working with. And that kind of sent me on the trajectory of being interested in the broader left and anarchism. And eventually I had a crisis of tendency and left anarchism behind. It sort of got me on my trajectory towards the broader left, and not just that, spirituality and magic, and how he sort of fuses concepts from the spiritual and the magical in with his political ideology as well. That was something that definitely interested me, and sort of the way that he views art as magic and art having the potential to transform consciousness, and how that can be used as a tool to sort of steer human consciousness towards better ends. That's something that I think is incredibly politically potent. And especially now that we're in this age where, you know, history is kind of repeating itself, we're caught on this sort of hauntological loop. The culture seems to be becoming more stagnant and dying. you know, our, you know, society is no longer really a thing. You know, we're all now kind of atomized consumers living these individualistic lives. I think that his message is something that's definitely worth re-exploring, and I think it's definitely one that is a roadmap towards hope for a brighter future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love Alan Moore. One of the most misunderstood, like, writers ever.
100%. 100%.
Yeah, I kind of really like how precious he is about the portrayal of his works in media that he does not a part of, which has happened with him constantly.
It's such a scary thing, especially like as a writer, because people love his like writing so very much, but like they just want to be like, oh, well, I'm going to make a sequel to this, and then I will be great as well. Like,
they have a watch-
I will
they
make this adaptation.
DC is now selling a Watchmen comic that is not has nothing to do with Alan Moore. That's gone on beyond it.
Well, I'm sure you know about this, but Jeff, like, do you know like why Watchmen has been in print forever? Because like once it goes out of like as per the agreement, once it goes out of print, like the rights revert back to Alan Moore.
So that's why they come up with these absolute editions and all these special editions that you see.
That's why it'll and it'll come out until Alan Moore is dead.
They sell, and that's why they made the movie, I'm sure too.
Yeah,
I mean, he's even gone as far as to sort of relinquish proceeds to the artists of the graphic novels.
Yeah.
Rather than whenever there's sort of a film adaptation made, because obviously he inevitably gets a cut, but he's so grumpy in his principles that he's even gone as far as to sort of relinquish proceeds to the like 100% of the proceeds to the artists whenever a movie adaptation has been made that he disapproves of. And I mean, I don't blame him, because I mean, before I was sort of politically, you know, curious, I just kind of thought he was being grumpy and like weird. But now I sort of, as you know, what now I'm looking at his work through a much more politically, I guess, I don't want to use any dumb words, a more politically like astute lens in that regard. I kind of understand now why he was frustrated by, you know, because like, again, someone like Zack Snyder, who, you know, has an authoritarian tint to every single piece of work he's done directing an Alan Moore film makes absolutely no sense. I mean, you know, someone like Zack Snyder is the person who wants to make give us bless humanity with a live action adaptation of Atlas Shrugged, for Christ's sake.
Oh my god.
You know, there's like a
I'm kind of curious and like, want to see that horror show though.
Oh.
Yeah. There's like a through line of horror in a lot of his work. I mean, 300 and you know, so much of his work is sort of this glorification of authoritarianism, and I definitely don't think he captured the subtext of Watchmen at all. Especially, and you know, so much of Alan Moore's work is political. All of it is political. All of it has some form of political, you know, well, most of it anyway, has some form of political underpinning, and every single adaptation of his work has sort of really watered that down. I mean, the Wachowski V for Vendetta sort of made V this sort of vaguely liberal activist, you know, kind of working against a Bush-era caricature rather than the, you know, anarchist revolutionary versus the far-right fascist.
Yeah, they turned him into the Democrats.
Yeah. Like, it's not V making that the most powerful man fall in love with his computer and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very much it's really interesting. But Alan Moore is definitely somebody who has had like a huge impact on me in terms of like the way that I view creativity, my spiritual trajectory, and my political trajectory as well. So it was more of like a love project to a hero. It was kind of like a little love slash passion project to somebody who I really admire.
That was an excellent video, and if you haven't watched it, definitely check it out, everybody.
I will definitely check that out.
And I will say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to speak over you. I would also say that you talked a little bit about how Alan Moore talked about art and magic, and one of the things that I find the most interesting about this, and I'm not sure if this was something that you touched on, memory's failing me right now, on the particulars of that, but when he talks about art and magic, he's not speaking metaphorically. Art is basically magic from a human being's brain.
I mean, yeah, that's one of the big like things they used to ding him with. They'd be like, oh, this crazy old wizard man. like, because he's like interested in like, you know, mysticism and stuff.
He's a ceremonial magician, and he's like a straight up occultist, and like, you know, I take on the moniker of witch myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not necessarily a ceremonial magician, even though I have like messed around with ceremonial magic before. I'm more of like a pagan in that regard. Mm-hmm. But yeah, his spiritual paradigm is definitely something that a lot of people have tried to use to discredit him.
Mm-hmm.
Or make him sort of seem like he's not worth listening to. But yeah, he believes again in magic, and believes that magic is, his definition of magic is, you know, a purposeful engagement with the phenomenon of consciousness, which is something that we all do all the time in various different forms. So every single person in that regard is a magician.
Yeah.
Specifically creative people, artists, like there are people who are magicians that wouldn't even consider themselves to be magicians. You know, anything that's sort of a purposeful engagement with consciousness, anything that alters consciousness, these all exist within the domain of magic, and magical phenomena. So yeah, it's a philosophical underpinning, and it's also a philosophical lens for viewing reality as well. It's not everybody's cup of tea though. Like not everybody is going to think that way, or not everybody's sort of interested in opening themselves up to these sort of mystical ideas and experiences, and that's fine because it means more fun for those of us who are. It's not necessarily going to be everybody's cup of tea, and it doesn't have to be either. I mean, it's called esoteric for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's hidden, forbidden knowledge at the end of the day, and it's not going to appeal to everyone. So, you know, that's kind of my thing. I really think that when a lot of people, especially on the left, think that when you talk about these concepts, you're proselytizing, or you're saying this is like the one true way. not at all, you know, like I said, there's a reason why it's called esoteric.
Right.
Because it's not meant to be for everybody.
It's almost like another way of like looking at the information that's given to you in the world.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I would say that like I really find that worldview interesting, whether or not I subscribe to it. I haven't really, you know, thought about it enough, and I haven't really kind of explored it. But the idea that that essentially every person is sort of capable of magic in the way that you know, you and Moore talk about, means that human beings are fundamentally productive. And in a sort of Marxist sort of add-on to that, essentially thinking and creating and sharing ideas is a form of production. And
it is.
That is that jives well in a certain sense with the sort of Marxian logic.
I mean, Alan Moore has talked about it several times, mm-hmm. I believe, about how, you know, you know, something like the Communist Manifesto or Das Kapital is basically one big grimoire. It's like a huge magical text, a mm-hmm. huge magical sort of edict in that regard. You know, if you start to think about things from the magician's mindset or a magical perspective, you start to sort of hack into these strange areas of the collective unconscious that have a lot of very interesting things that you can unearth and sort of bring back. But like I said, it's not a thing that's for everyone. There are only some people who have the inclination to do that kind of work, mm-hmm. Which is why I think it's important for the left to kind of, you know, allow that kind of work to be done
mm-hmm.
uninterrupted. I mean, you know, back during, you know, the 20th century, one massive kind of movement, and I mean, I made a video about this as well, that was doing this with the Dadaist movement. And the Dadaists mm-hmm. were, you know, far kind of left communist artists, and they were also heavily involved in the occult, and a lot of their work and their art was about bypassing the logical, you know, because obviously the Dadaist movement occurred after World War One, and
mm-hmm.
you know, World War One basically was like, it was sort of a rebellion against, you know, the kind of mechanized, industrial, logical mode that had led us to that disaster, the Dadaists then decided that they were going to embrace nonsense and absurdity as a response to that kind of rigid, mechanized logic. And it was all about diving into the realm of the unconscious and allowing it to speak. And, you know, even things like automatic writing, automatic drawing, these are things that, you know, were their way of trying to sort of communicate with the unconscious and bringing up, you know, what it was supposed to, what they were trying to sort of unearth from this sort of unknown aspect of our psyche.
Yeah.
They were doing explorative work that ended up being incredibly politically potent. And, you know, not everybody is going to take on that role of the magician or of the seeker, but there are people who have done that historically. And, like, you know, I think it's important for us to evaluate their legacy and protect it as well. And I guess that's why I made, you know, the Alan Moore video, because it's like there's a whole new generation of left people who don't know who he is, or who haven't really engaged with his work, or who have been, who have heard somewhere that he's just some crazy magician man who doesn't know anything or isn't worth listening to in that regard. And you know, I thought it would be, I thought it was incredibly interesting for to sort of, you know, showcase his legacy and talk about it, as well as other sort of spiritually minded leftists from the past as well.
And I think I have two kind of more thoughts on this. Specifically on Alan Moore. One is that when you start to think in these sort of mystical terms, you sort of relax some of these sort of fixed, or at least sort of like the way that we think about things as fixed realities that exist in the world. And it sort of makes it, even if you're only using it as a metaphor, it makes it, it gives you opportunities to sort of think of things on different, on almost on like different ground, on different terms. You know, it's almost like being standing on land and, you know, sitting in water or something like that. It sort of really does make these ideas that we think about that exist that are purely ideas. Capitalism is a organization of society that is material because of because people have agreed to it, and there are resources that have been distributed along those lines. But I guess these sort of more mystical approaches give the opportunity to sort of rethink them in a way that actually, in a sort of interesting, maybe even counterintuitive sense, ways that they can sort of grab onto with their minds.
Exactly. You know, like I said, it's all about sort of you know, magic can be used to create illusions, but it can also be used to dispel them as well. And, you know, we're living under so many grand authoritarian illusions in reality, whether that be sort of this technocratic surveillance state that's being implemented, or capitalism itself, or, you know, all of these different authoritative mechanisms. As magicians, artists, people who are purposefully engaging with our own consciousness and the consciousness of thousands of other people, you know, we are also kind of charged with that onus to work consciously to dispel those illusions as well, because that's part of being or donning the magician's high mindset is consciously sort of engaging with ideas, engaging with ideas as if they were conscious themselves. It's very interesting territory for sure. It's a fun little rabbit hole to dive down.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of fiction that kind of does stuff like that. There's this series I watch called Gundam, and it's about, like, ostensibly it's about, like, robots, but really it's kind of a, I don't know if you've heard of The High Frontier. It's, like, a speculative kind of thing by this guy called Gerard K. O'Neill. It's about how, like, we'll all go into space and we'll invent these colonies, and, like, in some, like, somebody's like, hey, but what about when we go out there? What about classicism and poor, like, poverty and stuff? Like, how will all these things account? And basically, his answer is like, oh, we'll figure it out.
Oh, that's Elon Musk.
Yeah. Jeff Bezos, when he did his blue thing, whatever, like, he was directly, like, using the High Frontier. Like, he was using art from it and stuff. And like basically like this series is just he serves to be like
a, he used no, it as a
all
roadmap.
These all these problems will continue and it will just like if we never ever fix them and just like focus on finishing these wars, it'll just be like the spiral that will always happen. Like,
oh my god.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit of Ursula K. Le Guin and her series of her book, The Dispossessed as well, which was kind of the first interaction I had with anarchist utopian fiction, and sort of this imagining of the future. You know, one other left theorist that I've been like very interested in for many years is Mark Fisher, and you know, his sort of idea. He kind of talks about hauntology and the fact that we are unable to imagine new futures, that the system we're living under has sort of robbed us of our ability to.
Yeah, that is very true. When we think of the future, we only think of like the three favorite movies that we've seen about it. Like,
yeah. And that's the thing. That's the sort of job of the magician, according to Alan Moore. He has this sort of this idea of solve et coagula, which is it's an idea in alchemy, in hermetic alchemy. Mm-hmm. And it's the idea, so solve is sort of deconstruction and coagula is reconstruction, and how, you know, 20th century postmodernism kind of deconstructed everything, which then left human consciousness rudderless, and we're sort of on this endless cycle of repetitive consumption and sort of repetitive creation as well, how everything's just sort of a form of something that has come before it, and there's nothing new anymore. And you know, the job of the magician and artist now is to practice coagula and start to reconstruct things from the deconstructed components of our culture. Otherwise we'll be left with a wasteland, which is basically what I believe we're operating in right now, is sort of this wasteland of nothingness, our culture sort of eroding and society eroding. I mean, we had we were on Low Society a couple of weeks ago. We had David Graeber on, and he said this really interesting thing about the coronavirus and how it's basically exposed how there is no society anymore, and society is what breeds culture. And you know, like, you know, during the Blair era in the UK, you know, they were trying to sort of export Britpop across to show, you know, British hegemonic power. And but the thing that they but at the same time they got rid of, you know, benefits. They were doing mass austerity, and you know, maybe the next Beatles are now stacking shelves somewhere because they don't have the time or creative space to do anything. And then we have a culture where there's no new musicians, there are no new artists, there are no new interesting things happening culturally because everybody's sort of turned into this atomized, alienated like consumer. And yeah, it's kind of a bleak future. And if we don't have people who are able to think and imagine and envision new futures or to inspire us through delving into the collective unconscious and unearthing things that bring healing and resonance, then, you know, we're kind of screwed in that regard. So magicians of the 21st century have to take our job very seriously.
Yeah. I mean, that is pretty true about like America, because like we've kind of never had culture. So we've only like, plus we're so big, we've only been able to like steal it, like to like, because they've used America. Like that was one of our big weapons in the Cold War. They were like, they want to have our culture.
Blue jeans and
the premier of Russia couldn't get it. He agreed with Nixon because he wanted to go to Disney World or something like that.
That was Khrushchev. Yeah, Khrushchev went to Disney.
Yeah,
because you know I'm a Disney historian.
You're our Disney historian, Robert. Thank you for joining. Are you free now? Are you free to join the conversation?
Yeah, my boss walked out. I don't have much battery left, though. I left my charger in the car, but...
Cool.
Yeah, it's just me up here.
Well, cool. You know, so really quick, Angie mentioned Mark Fisher, and I kind of always have a copy of Capitalist Realism right near me. And you kind of talked about the idea that's kind of put forward in the book that essentially this is the reality, like the capitalist structures that we have in our society are basically all that we like are. And it's a way of thinking, obviously, but it's all that is possible and it's all that we can ever hope for. And even thinking that that kind of a world isn't possible is sort of like not real. And you've also done a video on Mark Fisher on with Peter Coffin Exiting the Vampire Castle. Yeah. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. It was basically a dramatization of his essay, which kind of explored the neoliberal mode within left spaces in terms of cancel, you know, manifesting itself as cancel culture. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we've talked extensively about that at the beginning of the podcast, sort of, you know, this managerial affect, this sort of punitive, you know, use of social justice that's levied against, you know, the working class. And I guess in our dramatization of it, Peter the vampire kind of represents the liberal sort of establishment's attitude towards punitive social justice, and I'm just some random person that kind of gets caught in the line of fire in that regard.
Yeah.
And it was also based on personal experience too, because like I've also had many run-ins. I mean, there was a massive one at the beginning of my YouTube career as a content creator, where I was doxxed and hacked and you know, harassed for days on end because of some tangential connection to someone who allegedly did something bad. People saw that as an opportunity to, or as an excuse to sort of act out punitively, mm-hmm. In this really horrible, like dehumanizing way that was incredibly psychologically scarring as well. Mm-hmm. And I guess that incident then was what basically got me questioning this system of incentives, seeing how this sort of mode of cancel culture is something that had been going on beneath the surface for ages, that people were too kind of afraid to question because they were materially incentivized not to. Mm-hmm. And they sort of would throw peers under the bus. It's kind of a mode that operates among the pundit class, mm-hmm. of the liberal left, basically. This sort of weird transactional thing between the pundit class of the liberal left, their peers, and also their audiences, this weird culture of public executions and shaming and scandal that has emerged. And it's very medieval and
very Protestant,
it's very Catholic. It's very medieval. It's very it's very Protestant. It's Catholic. Like in the Vampire Castle essay, Mark Fisher said, he quoted Nietzsche, the idea that something worse than Christianity would emerge. And I think that neoliberal social justice is exactly that. I think it's worse than Christianity. Ben Bruges says this really interesting thing where, at least in Christianity, you can be forgiven. Whereas here, in this mode, you have to constantly self-flagellate until, you know, your back is raw and bloody. And even then you still need to flagellate some more because it's original sin that you must constantly atone for. Whatever bad thing might be going on in your head about X minority, your implicit bias, mm-hmm. which is something that's completely involuntary, mm-hmm. and something that most people can't control. Right. I don't care if somebody has an implicit bias against Black people. I care about the fact that we live in an economic system that gives certain people power to act on those implicit biases. Otherwise, I wouldn't care if someone saw me and thought like my hair looked weird, or they weren't attracted to my features, mm-hmm. or they thought that, oh, they clutched their purse a little harder when I was walking past them at night. I don't give a shit about any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. I care about my economic needs being met. I don't care about what goes on in anyone's individual head.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have a couple more minutes, but you've been so generous with your time. I did want to talk about to go back to the mystical a bit. You do like to talk about things like the zodiac and stuff like that. And a friend of mine actually asked the question, somewhat jokingly, he asked, "Do you think that the zodiac is Zoroastrian cultural appropriation?"
Very well could be, but it's good fun. So sorry to the Zoroastrians. You're just gonna have to put up with my shameless culture vulture.
Yeah,
my shameless culture vultureism. That's my answer to that. But yeah, I like, you know, I kind of think that it's an interesting self-reflective tool. Uh-huh. I don't necessarily see it as anything supernatural, but I think anything that gets you thinking about yourself and thinking about your personality and reflecting inwardly can be useful and empowering too in a certain aspect. Like I when I sort of figured out that I was an air sign, because Aquarius is like an air sign, and an air has a lot to do with the mind, the intellect, and communication, and all of those things. It felt quite empowering for me because I was like, oh, that's basically the thing that makes me tick, and that's what I'm the most interested in. And it gave me more permission, I guess, to double down on the things that I already felt were my superpowers in that regard. It can be an interesting way of sort of unlocking your superpowers. And feeling kind of personally empowered by them. But it's not necessarily like a political thing. It's just a thing that I do that's fun for me.
Yeah.
But I think it is weird when people are a little bit too like against like zodiac stuff. Like
they're like, trying to like very, rule it out and make it taboo. They're trying to cancel it.
It's like, what do you think? Because I've always read the Zodiac ever since I was a kid. It was like the first thing I ever checked out in the newspaper that wasn't like the funnies.
Well, but, no, like, I'm not somebody who like reads, because that's the thing is astrology, again, it's esoteric. You're talking about like this sort of consumerist version of it, which is like, here's what's going to happen to you on Tuesday. Whereas there's a deeper, more esoteric element of it, which most people don't know about, because again, it's esoteric. Which is more about sort of exploring different aspects of your psyche. It's like a Jungian practice almost, different elements of your psyche and your personality in a way that makes you work more optimally as like a person and feel more empowered as a person. And that's kind of the stuff that I'm interested in, not necessarily like trying to predict the future or use it as a way of marking people permanently or pathologizing them or anything like that.
Yeah. It only matters to you if it matters to you, and if it doesn't, then whatever.
Exactly. But yeah, it's kind of one of those things that like I have a lot of sense of humor about myself in that regard. Like I'm okay with people thinking that I'm some weird airy fairy woo woo lady because I am, and I have big orb energy, and that makes some people mad. But whatever.
Are you a Marianne Williamson fan at all?
No, not really, but I do respect the orb energy when I see it, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least she brightened up the field a little bit.
Yeah.
Like,
this is a pro this is a pro Marianne podcast, so
Yeah, she definitely bought in some of that Pocahontas like hate with all the colors of the wind energy.
Oh my God. So
Yeah.
Angie, this is Robert. I wanted to ask you, because like I come from kind of a weird place where I say, I'm an atheist and I don't believe in any of that. But I find like in my leisure time, like a lot of my thoughts, like I read like a lot of esoteric things and I watch like a lot of stuff. So it's like, is there any kind of like Afrocentric, kind of like Bruja, like culture, like I like something you can guide me towards, because it's like, how many times can I read about John Dee and like, Aleister Crowley? Like I'm bored now.
I mean, I was going to say, like, number one, you can be an atheist and be into the esoteric. Like so many occultists are atheists. I'm largely agnostic myself. That like just because you have a spiritual paradigm doesn't mean that you necessarily believe in the supernatural. Like some people see it purely as metaphoric psychological exercise. One that can lead to a form of self-knowledge and self-actualization in that regard. So there are people who are occultists that don't have a supernatural or mystical attachment to any of these ideas at all. They see them purely as metaphorical tools, and they're creative people, so they resonate more with these sorts of ritualistic practices. But in terms of something that isn't necessarily rooted in the Western tradition of the esoteric, I would say look at Ifa, the Yoruba tradition. You know, there's this really great book called Jambalaya by Louis Satish, which is a good introduction to sort of the African-American iteration of the Yoruba And I'm from Nigeria. I'm half Nigerian, so I definitely resonate with the Yoruba kind of paradigm a lot, basically because it's like where I'm from. But the Yoruba tradition is definitely very rich in terms of its esoteric history and its spiritual contribution to humanity. And African mysticism definitely doesn't get the credit that it deserves, in my opinion. Like it's often sort of looked down upon. But yeah, definitely check that out if you're interested in something less Western based.
And it's so
New Orleans. Thank you so much. I'm gonna do that.
New Orleans is kind of like you know, it's profited on, like, because of all the shops and stuff. Like
yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah. New Orleans is somewhere I've always wanted to visit. It's very interesting in terms of how the Yoruba religion sort of took root there in African American mm-hmm. communities, and it got fused with you know, different mystic schools from different parts of Africa and became its very sort of unique thing, and then how that intersected with like the market and capitalism and kind of became this sort of there are all kinds of different forms that it manifests itself in. I have a video on spirituality and capitalism mm-hmm. where I specifically talk about, you know, the way in which spiritual ideas that are intangible are then sort of brought into the realm of consumerism.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something else that's worth checking out. But yeah, I need to go eat dinner now.
Okay, so. Well, thank you. I guess, do you want to just talk a little bit about your channel and Low Society, and how can we support and find more information sure. about your stuff? I'm sorry, I don't mean to keep you any longer.
No problem at all. It's the time difference in England, that's why.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for having me on. I had a great time chatting with you guys. I really appreciate it. And feel free to hit me up again in future. My Low Society podcast, you can find us on all major platforms that do podcasts. I also am on Twitter @SpeaksAngie, and all the links to my stuff are there. I also, my YouTube channel is called Angie Speaks, and I'm currently working on a new video now. It's going to take me a while to put out. So if you want to catch up on old stuff that I've made on Angie Speaks, or if you want to hear from me weekly, I am on Low Society Pod, and you can check out my channel, check out my Twitter.
Thank you so much. Hope you have a great night. And if you ever do come to New Orleans, please don't hesitate to like look us up. We would love to have
Hell
you on
yeah.
the show live. That would
Hell
be so
yeah.
much fun.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Take care. Enjoy your dinner.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Have a good evening.
Good
Bye.
Night. Good
Bye.
Night. Yeah, that was great, guys. So
I like her so much.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks to Angie Speaks. She is a really interesting and really smart person. It was really great to talk to her. I've been meaning to have her come on the show for some time, and you know, glad that we did get to talk with her. So, guys, anything from y'all on the way out?
No, just thanks for booking cool people, Jeff. I know that you've been like doing all the heavy lifting on the pod. Since coronavirus.
Oh, that's no problem. It's all
good.
Job, we
buddy.
Can make it happen. Please say more nice things about me on the air.
Good job, man.
Cool. Anyway, you can check out Good Morning Comrade at goodmorningcomrade.com. You can listen to us on Tuesdays on WHIV-FM. You can also get more information, goodmorningcomrade.com. Follow me on Twitter @EminentProf. Follow Robert and the show on Twitter @ComradeMorning. All right, everybody. Love you. Bye.
Peace.